This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Today, we're talking to Dr. Kenda Knowles, who is a senior research fellow at Rhodes University and also works at the South African Radio Astronomy Observatory. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Amalia. Very happy to be here.
Dr. Knowles, can you tell us about your journey? I recall reading up that you started, well, you were stirred as a 10-year-old with the constellation of Orion, and then you went on to study computational physics at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and then becoming a leading astrophysicist in South Africa.
So I had the privilege of growing up with exceptional night skies. When I was first in Joburg and later moving to KZN, I grew up on the outskirts of cities. And so you obviously have better sky viewing than you do if you're living in the middle of places like Joburg. And I really enjoyed star watching both on my own and with my family. But I had never considered astronomy as a career path until I was already in university. During the high school sort of years, when I'm not planning, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I knew everything I didn't want to do. So all the things that when you're doing well academically, people expect you to go into, I didn't want to do any of that. And I thought physics would be really interesting. But my parents were understandably not incredibly confident about my job prospects with that. I had a friend at high school who did want to study astronomy, and she'd done a lot of investigation, and she found out about this computational physics degree at our home institute. And this was really important because if I was going to study after school, it had to be locally and I had to get funding because otherwise we couldn't afford it. And so I'd looked into things like forensic pathology was really interesting and genetics, but neither of those were provided in Pietermaritzburg, where I grew up. And this computational physics degree sounded like it hit all the notes that I was interested in, where physics is helping you explain our environment and how everything works. But it also has a large computer science programming aspect that made my parents feel a bit more comfortable about job prospects. So yeah, I went to University of KwaZulu-Natal in Pietermaritzburg to do computational physics. And during those studies, I found out about this SKA project, which sort of led me into that direction of astronomy. And as they say, the rest is history.
Wow, what a story. So it was all these discoveries that then pushed you through to find your pathway. And I think it's so important about keeping an open mind, especially when you're younger, of what could be possible.
Exactly. And I think it was also very important that I never had any pressure from outside influences, whether it was family or otherwise, on what direction I needed to take. I know a lot of women in particular struggle with that, where there's preconceived notions about what they should or shouldn't be doing.
And the reality is that some of those advisors may not have a clue about the field that you're interested in. It's just purely about what they've been exposed to and yes, their narrow views.
Exactly.
Continuing with this sort of trajectory of going from student on to becoming a professional, you were a student in the NRF SARAO, Human Capital Development Program. Can you share how this program shaped your career trajectory and also what opportunities it opened up for you as a young woman entering the field?
Yes, so the NRF SARAO, that's the South African Radio Astronomy Observatory. When I initially got involved with them from the funding level, it was the Square Kilometre Array Africa project, which has now since become SARAO. And the story behind that is that there was this SKA project, global project, that was sort of being planned, and South Africa and Australia they eventually became the two countries bidding to host the project. And so what South Africa had done is they put a lot of effort into saying, well, look, if we're going to host this large radio astronomy project, we want to make sure that South Africans are going to be the ones, or at least a large portion of the people, actually using the instrument and doing the science, making the discoveries. And I think at the time we had 5 professional radio astronomers in the country, and says, well, that's not going to be enough. We need to actually do it to produce this human capital. And that's where this funding program sort of started, and then it now then became SORAYO under the NRF funding structure. But I first started being, I think my first year of funding with them was honours. And so through my university experience and maybe blind luck in Maritzburg, we happened to have a cohort of students where at least half of us were interested in astronomy. And so between all of us, we had a lot of discussion, and then we found out about this funding opportunity, and that sort of gave the direction of radio astronomy specifically. And then, through that, I guess the funding gives you a little bit of more financial freedom. So I could then go down to Cape Town to start doing coursework for my master's in astronomy, and that obviously helps grow your networks. It helps you meet new people and just grow, develop your own boundaries, basically. And through my associations, both with people I knew at Maritzburg, they put me in touch with Professor Kavalan Moodley, who was in the Westville branch of UKZN at the time, because Maritzburg, we didn't actually have any astronomers. But I ended up doing a vacation project with him at the end of honours, made that connection, went to Cape Town, had a bit of a wobble. I got really, really sick and had to discontinue and come back home to recover. And Prof. Moodley reached out to me and said, well, if you want to continue with research, he's happy to work with me. And so I ended up moving to Durban, and that really formed the basis of my postgraduate studies, as well as the stepping stones of my early career as a researcher.
There's two things that I want to tap into in what you've mentioned there. The one aspect is about funding and the fact that not everyone is born with a silver spoon and has access to financial support. But if you make a conscientious effort, you can identify sources of funding in order to pursue your dream. And then the second is the importance about networking and building out those associations. So if you could just tap into those two points for us.
Sure. So first on the funding, I was still, if you think about the general typical South African or African, I was still quite privileged. The fact that, yes, I got my own funding that paid for my costs and helped pay for living expenses. But other than, I did still pay rent living at home. I grew up with quite a strict background, which I think did me lots of favors moving forward. But I didn't have to carry my family. There's a lot of South African students that I've met actually now being on the supervising side of things that have really opened up my eyes to how critical funding is for a lot of students who they have the drive, they have the passion, and they're capable, but without that funding, they really just don't have access to the opportunities. And I think that's where initiatives like the Human Capital Development Program with SORAYO are so fundamental. And unfortunately, they can't fund everyone. Finance is finite. But the bit that they do is the impact that they've made on astronomy in this country, radio astronomy specifically, is, excuse the pun, but it's astronomical. And it's really rewarding to see a lot of students come up and make use of those funding opportunities and really, really go far with it. On your second point of networks, yes, so networking is not something that I've ever thought myself particularly good at, and it's something I still struggle with sometimes, but I have learned that it is pivotal. And I think that probably it's not astronomy specific. I think this goes with just life in general. But you need to have a good basis of knowledge. You need to be competent and be able to do the work, but your networks are what help open the doors to different opportunities. With Prof. Moodley, I was exceptionally lucky to have him as a supervisor. I came into it with quite a unique situation where I remember sitting down at my very first meeting with him for research, and he sort of had three box files on three different astronomy topics. And he said, these are the topics he's interested in. I need to go away, do some investigation, figure out which one I'm interested in, and we'll go from there. And the one that I happened to pick, which is actually the field I still work in, it wasn't his niche. So he didn't have all of the skills needed in order to train me, but he had networks. And so I got the opportunity to travel a lot, and I go visit people around the world who had the skills that I needed in order to train me. And so without his networks, I wouldn't have grown and developed my own networks, which are now serving me and my own students moving forward.
So interesting and so important are these like soft skills that you don't consciously think about when you start out, but are absolutely critical.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's knowing to ask the questions. And I think this is where having good mentors, good supervisory teams is really important, because things like develop your networks is not something I had ever thought critically about, that, this was something I actually needed to work on and to develop. A lot of the skills, particularly the soft skills that people gain, I think during research careers specifically, you gain them by doing, and you're not really that conscious of what you are developing as you're developing them. And so being able to sit down with mentors, or have mentors sit down with you and say, these are the questions you should be thinking about, and they're going to be relevant in 3, 4, 5 years' time. If you only start thinking about them 5 years down the line, it might be a bit too late. So start thinking about them now, and planning and networking is one of those big things that I've found helps, both in the research sphere of, no one can do everything. And so collaboration is a huge part of radio astronomy, and I think it's something that the South African community in particular does really well in terms of collaboration versus competition. Competition is important. It does help drive scientific excellence, but I think collaboration is even more important, particularly if it's done well. And so we collaborate with, people throughout South Africa, but also around the globe. And those networks are really important to drive the science, but also to give your own students opportunities. Maybe that opens up the next opportunity for them to develop a PhD or a job position that they hadn't thought of before.
So thinking about research, thinking about collaborations, I read that in 2021 you had led an international team which released a massive amount of data through the Meerkat Galaxy Cluster Legacy Survey. Now, as I'm talking, I'm just saying these names and I have no depth or knowledge about them. So can you explain in accessible terms what this research means for our understanding of the universe and why this data release is so important for the global astronomy community?
Sure. So MGCLS was actually probably one of the most recent pivotal moments of my career. What had happened is that the SOREOs, that's the observatory that runs the Meerkat instrument. So there's a bit of background here. So the Square Kilometre Array project, the bidding was happening, and during that bidding, South Africa said, well, whether we get it or not, we want to make sure that we have a premier instrument all of our own. And so the government backed the development, building, engineering, running of this telescope called the Meerkat. So Meer as in Afrikaans, Moore, Karoo Array Telescope. And the Meerkat at the moment is the most sensitive instrument in radio frequency that it operates. It's beautiful. And it sits in the middle of our Karoo Desert, but they have different modes in which they operate. And when the instrument first came online, you never get all modes simultaneously. You start out with one, and then you develop out more. So with the first mode that they developed, it was at a particular frequency range, and it was just continuum. So that means just imaging. And so they didn't want the instrument to lie fallow, because telescope time is money. So Meerkat is quite special, in which case the array itself, how it was designed, where the antennas go, all those sorts of things were sort of designed around specific science projects that the community wanted to do. So these are the large survey projects, and they range from people looking at neutral hydrogen, both nearby and far away, to people looking at time domains, so things that go flash on and off. We try and understand why. But some of those projects could only start when newer modes were available. So there was a lot of telescope time in the early days that they wanted to fill. And so what the observatory decided to do was start taking data for several different legacy projects. And one of these was the Meerkat Galaxy Cluster Legacy Project. So galaxy clusters are the largest objects that we know of in the universe that are bound by gravity. And they sit at this really interesting place between cosmology, which is sort of where people are studying what the universe as a whole is doing. How did it start? How did it grow? What's it done in between to get to the pattern that we see now? And the astrophysics side of it, which is sort of all the smaller stuff. Although obviously when I say small, we're still talking about scales of billions of light years. And so if you can study, you need to study galaxy clusters in order to help understand how the universe has built its large scale structure. And looking at this pattern of large scale structure can tell you something about how the universe started in the first place, what ingredients were there in what sort of different volumes, or amounts rather. But then if you actually look at the clusters themselves, they're really unique laboratories, really, that can tell us something about how the galaxies inside them evolve in this very dense environment. They also contain clues about magnetic fields or plasma physics on these extremely large scales. And they also have extreme events like cluster mergers, which actually produce extreme energies. I think they're probably some of the most extreme events we know of in the universe. So MGCLS, because it was this large sample, so we're talking over 100 different targets scattered across the southern sky, and the quality of the data that Meerkat could provide, it means we got this large volume of data on galaxy clusters, which are these unique objects, but in quite unprecedented detail that had been obtained before. And so radio in particular helps us to, it's a window or provides a window into different phenomena that are invisible at other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. So, for example, if you look at a cluster in optical, you're going to see some details that you won't see in radio, but in the radio, the reverse is also true. You'll be able to see things that you just can't see anywhere else. So, magnetic fields and cosmic rays, so these are relativistic, which means things traveling very close to the speed of light, electrons, protons, trying to understand how these cosmic rays are transported throughout the system, what's happening with the magnetic fields. How do they grow? How do they evolve? And so, yeah, MGCLS basically helps us to study these in really good detail for a large number of systems, which is quite rare. And then the other part of it is the fact that this large data set was made publicly available. And this is critical because I think such a these big legacy surveys, they have to be made publicly available because you want as many people as possible to be able to access the data. And this helps democratize science so that you're not bound by being knowing the right people or being part of the right teams in order to access really interesting scientific data. And when it is made publicly available, you're also multiplying the scientific output. The more people looking at something, each maybe with their own science ideas, because that's the other great thing about the MGCLS and Meerkat as a whole, is that the design of the telescope, it has quite a large region of sky that it can see at one time, which means the thing that you maybe pointed the telescope at for your science, you'll be able to see it, great, but it's also going to show you a bunch of other stuff that someone else might be interested in for completely different reasons. So the same data can then be used for a wide variety of science, and that's something we showed with the MGCLS paper. When we released the data, was trying to kind of give the community a snippet of these are the types of science that you might be able to do with these data sets, which has been great. And then it's also shown that it's a really good resource for helping the community as a whole prepare for something like the Square Kilometre Array, which is going to be a mega project with data volumes that are scary to think of at this stage.
Fascinating. I just love this view of the scalability, the availability of the data sets, opening those opportunities for other people to not go and do the legwork and the expense of collecting data, but being able to access them. You spoke about the massive volumes of data and the different facets in a way that different audiences could take from it or researchers. And I think that for me, one of the biggest impacts that we've been seeing in the last 2 years, 2, 3 years, has been about artificial intelligence. Can you tell us how AI's impacted on your field?
That's actually a great question because astronomy, we are really in the era now of global mega projects. So not just in the radio sphere, but we also, James Webb Space Telescope's turned on, producing beautiful data, and it's going to keep observing and it's going to producing more data. We have the Vera Rubin experiment, which is again in the optical, which I think is going to, I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but it's billions of galaxies that they're going to see over the course of the lifetime of that 10-year project. You just can't sift through that as a human. And one of the great things that AI and machine learning can potentially do is help us sift through all the information and really focus in on the oddities or the things where maybe there's going to be the most interesting outcome. For me as a scientist, as long as the science is rigorously done, it is interesting. If you can trust it, what you find is interesting, but it's not necessarily going to be transformational in terms of our understanding. And so when you have huge volumes of data that are going to be produced, it is possible that sometimes these transformational objects might be missed purely because they're just in this heap of other stuff. And so machine learning itself, the community for radio astronomy applications has grown a lot over the last 10 years or so. And we actually ran a skills development workshop at the beginning of February for students in South Africa and across Africa and in Switzerland, specifically focused on skills development in machine learning for radio astronomy. And so that workshop was funded by the NRF, by the Swiss National Science Foundation, and by SOREO itself. And it was great because there we actually were able to see, we had a huge amount of interest from students, which tell us that students are really seeing the value of this moving forward. But one of the great things that I learned actually coming out of that workshop was that machine learning, AI, it's a huge buzzword at the moment. Everyone wants to be involved in it. And I can understand why, particularly because having those skills will also make you more employable. Let's say you're researching, you are starting down the astronomy path, and you make a decision at some point that you don't want to stay in it, which is absolutely fine. Or maybe there just isn't a particular job that you want and you want to move into something else. Particularly if you're going to move into corporate, I think machine learning is certainly one of those things that corporate will sit up and listen if you have that on your resume. But one of the things I learned from that workshop is that just because AI and machine learning is a cool buzzword doesn't mean you actually need it. And a lot of people at the moment, they want to try apply machine learning to their data, but they aren't first asking themselves the question of whether it's needed for their data. And that was quite an interesting lesson for me to learn, even though I was technically helping run the workshop.
Great insight. Staying with the stream of employability and career prospects, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that your parents were a little concerned with the fact that you had an interest in physics and what was going to be your future. How gender friendly would you say the field of astronomy is, and what types of opportunities are available to women?
So, I can only really speak from my personal experience. And I think, certainly in the field of physical sciences, so the maths, statistics, physics, I think astronomy is probably doing better than most of the others. If I think about the gender distribution in my classes, so I was doing more physics, so we were maybe 20% women, which was a bit low. But when I moved into the astronomy sphere, suddenly you're starting to look at 35, 40, maybe even 50% gender parity, which I think is great. And one thing that was really encouraging when we ran this workshop is that just based on applications, and even with the students who we eventually were able to give spots to, we end up having just over 50% female participation. And that was purely, we didn't have to do any work to try to get that. That was just native from the applications and really high quality applications. And I think that was incredibly positive to see because I think for women, one of the challenges is whether it's our own voices inside our heads or those of our communities. I think everyone suffers from imposter syndrome at some point or can. It's not like it's a female only problem, but we do seem to suffer from it more. And so that often is a barrier to us even applying for things because we go, oh, well, I'm not going to make the bar, so I'm not going to try, or it's not worth it to try. And what the application showed me and the students who eventually started working on it is that maybe that is slowly starting to change, where women and girls are now starting to have a little bit more self-confidence to say, oh, actually, I can do it. I'm going to go give it a shot. And I think that's really important. So in terms of struggles, I think that women face in astronomy, certainly in research, imposter syndrome is a huge one. But there's also the common one of having to balance family demands and career demands. I think in a lot of cultures in South Africa, in particular, and Africa as a whole, I think the gender norms within a family structure are still quite strong, and so a lot of the silent work, I think, for families is still expected to be done by women. And so having to try and balance that with a demanding career is quite a challenge, but if institutions can help provide support for that, and there's also all the social aspects of as well, where changes need to happen on the social space that astronomy can't control, but can certainly help contribute to a positive outlook or a positive direction of change.
Recently, we had International Day for Women and Girls in Science, which was the 11th of February. And as you've just mentioned, that astronomy seems to be progressing better than many other physical science and STEM careers in terms of gender equality. But there's still a way to go in South Africa at the highest levels. What type of systemic changes do you think are necessary to achieve true gender equity in South African astronomy?
I think one of the big things is helping or encouraging women rather to apply for promotion. When I look at the, and this is why I think in my comment I specifically said at the higher levels, because at the undergraduate, even postgraduate level, we're doing really well. If I think about, my larger community at Rhodes University, we have a really, really good balance, if not even slightly more women than men in terms of our postgraduate student collective. But when I was looking at the list of radio astronomers in South Africa, so people who are employed at the sort of associate professor level in the country, the numbers have increased. That's great, but in terms of the number of women that were on that list, it was still very, very low. And that got me thinking about why that might be, because it's not that we don't have talented women. It's not even that we don't have talented women at the lecturer levels. It's sort of a question of why are they not moving up into the associate and professor levels at a university. So whether that is, I don't think there's a barrier bias at the institutes themselves. All of the ones that I've discussed this with, the hiring committees are very open to hiring women specifically, and I think that is one of the interventions that does need to be done. There needs to be a hiring process that you hire on merit, but you give priority to females, for example, or people who are underrepresented in your particular department, to help improve the diversity. But also, once you now have those people in, to encourage them and support them to climb those ladders. And that's not to say, people not climbing a ladder, that might be a choice. Maybe they're happy where they are. But for the most part, I think women in academia, we tend to do a lot of the administrative work, which is a gender bias. I've definitely sat in committees where there does seem to be this assumption from the male colleagues sitting at the table that the woman will take the minutes, for example. And that's something that, anyone can do. It's not like the male colleagues aren't capable of it, but it's a sort of weaponized incompetence of, oh, well, we know you will do it very well, so you can just do that. But there's a whole bunch of other administrative things that are required in a university post. And we tend to do those. I think women tend to be involved in them a lot and from early on, but they don't get the recognition for it, or they don't even realize that that's something that they should be getting recognition for, and therefore are eligible for promotion because you're doing the work anyway. So why don't you take that step up? And so I think having internal processes, even maybe just setting up mentors, I think that would be a really good thing, to set up internal mentors. They don't even have to be in the same field necessarily, but having senior mentors with your younger junior female staff to say, right, these are the sorts of things that you need to be thinking about if you want to start stepping up the ladder. Let's look at a time plan, give you some support about how you would go from here to your professor level, for example, in whatever time frame you're looking at. And then also, as I said, support structures for women who are balancing family demands, particularly those with young children. That can be, in academia, there's a culture of publish or perish, particularly when you're looking towards promotion, and that takes a lot of work. So if you're now going to be competing on a basis of what's on your CV, and you're competing with a bunch of other people, if you just didn't have the same amount of time as others because you've had family demands, that's going to create an inherent bias when people are just looking at CVs, and that needs to be taken into account. And I think there are definitely are some communities where this is starting to change and they're starting to implement these, but it needs to become systemic across institutes.
Great points. And that issue of time is so critical. We only have 24 hours in a day. And maybe for some women, it is thinking about more of a marathon than a sprint. And yes, I mean, you talk about the fact that there's kind of this sometimes a gender expectation of the woman will take the minutes, but that's actually still taking up my time. And if I'm doing admin, it's taking up my time away from what is going to get me the promotion, which is publications. So it's all of those factors that actually need to be structured. And like you say, it is these are systemic things which can happen, but there needs to be a conscious effort from the institution to enable it.
Yeah, and I don't think so. Some of those sort of implicit biases, I don't think they're malignant at all. There's no negative feeling that's behind them. It is just this inherent bias. And I think they don't, a lot of my colleagues don't even realize they have it until it's voiced. And so that's the other thing, is that making sure that the communities that the women that are working in, they feel safe to voice concerns like this. Because that's the other side of it. If you feel like there's going to be some sort of negative backlash for you speaking up and saying, well, hold on, this doesn't seem equitable. What can we change? If you don't feel safe to even start that conversation, nothing's going to change either.
Well, it sounds like you've created and fostered a positive environment that is open, that is receptive.
I hope so.
You are also very, I would say, passionate about your field, and you do a lot of outreach programs. You've spoken about the skills development workshop that you ran recently in February. And I know that you also give talks to public and high school students. What message do you share with young girls who are considering careers in science and the type of practical advice behind that? So, subject choices, job shadowing that you would give them if they wanted to follow in your footsteps?
So I think one of the f so in terms of practical things, if you want to go into astronomy, that's probably the easiest things to address. So you do need maths, you do need physics. There are ways, I think many universities have bridging programs if you haven't done the correct courses for a particular direction. There are bridging programs that you can do in your first 2 years, and that'll extend your program a bit. But I would highly recommend physics and maths at high school level. And then I think certainly if you're looking at astronomy in terms of a research career or interested in what that might be, research is incredibly different to coursework, where you're taking tests, you're doing exams. Research is completely different, and there's a lot of writing involved, which is not something you think about when you think about maths and physics. But that's where I would recommend, as you mentioned, something like job shadowing. So there will always be opportunities to approach researchers at your local institute. And if they don't do it, they might have connections or can put you in touch with someone. A lot of our supervision these days, particularly since COVID, is done virtually, so over Zoom or Google Meet or something like that. So it's no longer where you live in the country is no longer a barrier to being able to do research or investigate your opportunities. As long as you have an internet connection, you should be okay. But do things like vacation projects, volunteer your time, look into internship opportunities, where it's something that we ran at UKZN for a time. And as I said, that vacation project that I did with Prof Moodley was one of these things where you're giving up 6 weeks of your life over your December vacation, and you sort of you can dip your toe in the research ocean, where you're given sort of a bite-sized problem and you're meant to run with it and see how far you get. But you can interact with the researchers, you can ask questions, you're at the university as well, so you're seeing what their day-to-day existence is like. They also did actual sort of internship job shadowing, where a student would come in for the day and basically follow someone around and get a sense of what that actual career on a day-to-day basis might look like, because it can be very different to, seeing a media blast with all our pretty pictures. The amount of work that goes into making those pretty pictures is a lot less exciting than the pretty picture itself. And sort of getting that sense, I think that's really important. But also in terms of what I would say to students, or what I would like to say to students when I give these sort of talks, is that they need to remember that the doors are open. They just need to make that decision to walk through them. And there's always going to be people who say that you can't do something. They will have their reasons, but it's only you that can really decide what you can and cannot do. And so I think that sometimes needs, we all need a little bit of a reminder about that. And then there's also for people wanting to go into astronomy specifically, and particularly women, I would try and make sure that they know about the Supernova Foundation, which is an initiative set up by a colleague of mine at UWC, Prof. Michelle Lochner. And this is, it's a mentorship program between senior women in astronomy across the globe and younger researchers. I think at the moment you need to be at undergraduate level to get into it, but at least finding out about it, making those connections, finding out what resources are available from a very early on stage. I think there's nothing stopping schoolgirls from finding out about that and seeing what's out there.
Thanks for sharing those opportunities and, in a way, the pathway that helps people move ahead and explore. I love the idea of getting your toes wet into the research ocean before making a lifelong commitment, getting that exposure. Dr. Knowles, we are unfortunately running out of time. So, as we close today's conversation, please share a few words of inspiration that you'd like to pass on to girls and women who are listening to us.
So I think the one thing that I would like to say to the women and girls is try not put yourself in a box. It's something that I was told as a student when I was still at school. I had an English teacher, Mrs. Watson, who pulled me aside after class one day and kind of gave me a dressing down and saying, basically the essence of the message was, you consider yourself a science student, your maths, your physics. And so you don't try hard enough at English because you've already told yourself that it's not something that you would be good at because you're in this other box. And so you're limiting your opportunities by putting yourself in this box. And I think that is something that really, really stuck with me. And to this day, one of the proudest things I own is a little plastic trophy for creative writing in matric because it was, I took her conversation to heart. Well, that conversation to heart. And I think that's something I would want young women and girls to remember is that it's difficult enough for many of us to look towards the sciences and say, hey, I can do that. But for example, an astronomy career, yes, it is very technical, but you also need some level of creativity. It's investigation, it's exploration, no matter what field you're going into. And so try. Know yourself, learn about yourself, but also try don't put yourself in too much of a box because you might be limiting the opportunities that you give yourself. And that's where the interesting paths could lie.
That's such a fantastic message. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been fascinating having this view into your world of the skies above us, and wish you every success as you go on to further research and investigations.
Thank you so much. This has been really great.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we've been talking to Dr. Kendra Knowles, who is a senior research fellow at Rhodes University and also works at the South African Radio Astronomy Observatory.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.